I have now realized how much time has passed since I last put out an episode of a podcast of my own. Because I recorded with Colby back in November, and I never put that out, and now it's behind a Zencastr paywall that I'm never going to get access to because I'm not going to pay them. So, whatever. I recorded Birdmas with Bird. I have no idea how that went. I hope you guys enjoyed that back in December. And it's been a crazy year. A lot of things have happened. You know, a lot of you have been there for my broken arm arc. That took like 4 to 6 months out of my life. I got into a relationship, got out of a relationship, the usual stuff. But I got the free time now. And I want to record again. I want to get back into recording. I want to start putting out things more regularly. I don't know how beholden I'm going to be to that, but I'm going to try. So, we're back. We're back on the wagon. We are so back. We have never been so back. And yeah, I got nothing else to say. It's just, feels good to be here, baby.
Give me your hand. This red earth, it's in our skin. The Shauna say the color comes from all the blood that's been spilled fighting over the land. This is home.
Actually, I have an intro already recorded for this episode, and today that we are recording, April 16th, 2024, marks a year and a day since the last episode of this podcast was published.
Of course it does. Of course it does. Beautiful.
Yeah, it's
how it should be.
I have the Catholic worst that it has been two Easters that have not been baptized yet, because my Catholic work ethic is so strong. So strong that it has already inhabited me, and I am lazy for things that even involve my eternal soul.
Yeah, very true. I mean, at least you can claim you have a yearly podcast.
That's true. That is true. Annual. Annual?
One podcast per year. Please send me Patreon bucks.
Yeah, I've never set up a Patreon for this for good reason. It is. And the last episode actually was with you and Kato.
I know.
And that was a banger episode. That was a fucking hilarious episode.
That was great. Yeah, John Wilkes Booth, Time Assassin.
And the lore that Kato started that episode for us, that now to this day, there is a D&D character in our group named Boosie.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's where it started.
And then oh, yeah, I completely forgot about that, man. Yeah.
I think about it constantly. Every time I look, because I have Bucky's merch. I have plenty of Bucky's merch. Every time I look at it now, or every time it's talked about, my mind goes to Boosie.
As it should. That's exactly
as
how
it
should. Should
but be. This is a good reason why you're a guest to help get me back started into this. It was going to be Caleb, but I had work yesterday that I ran really late, so I had to reschedule. But it's because we talk regularly.
Yes, we do.
We got our weekly... Yeah, for anybody, what am I saying? For anybody listening,
for everybody listening.
This is a fucking podcast. Of course, for anybody listening. What the fuck?
It's gonna be your next guests.
Yeah.
Your next guests will listen to this.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah,
not
for
even
all
them,
20
maybe.
People that are gonna download this, I love you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the people listening, we do run a weekly D&D session where I am the DM. Mm-hmm. It has been a consideration that maybe we should record one of those sessions. But then I think about the amount of editing I would have to do.
Oh, yeah. Unimaginable.
Ryan would kill it.
Ryan
would kill it.
He's been pretty good the last few weeks, I think.
He has been pretty good, but you never know when that N-bomb is going to drop, and I'm too drunk to mark down the time.
Oh, I'm not that scared of the N-bombs. I'm more worried that we get another
hyper-rape
threat.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hyper-rape.
Yeah, oh, listen, that's also always... Ryan is a wild card.
And then his lovely, lovely girlfriend comes in and asks, why are you threatening to hyper-rape your friends?
I love his fiancée so much, dude. I love his fiancée so much. She got so pissed with him. She got, and the best part is, she missed the initial one. Second time around he was threatening to rape me. The second time he's threatening to rape me, she comes in, and they have the matching bathrobes with his mammogram on it.
Yeah, his mammogram.
Ryan, I know you're going to listen to this. I love you, man. But you are a fucking retard. His personally mammogrammed bathrobe. There's so much deep lore that the listeners will never know about that D&D session. But maybe
they'll get a glimpse of it, like in Lord of the Rings, where you don't see everything.
Yeah, there is a
little glimpses.
It's like the Hobbit when Sauron is named but not directly.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting a little tease. You're getting a little glimpse. Maybe we will record a session and it'll be so catastrophic that I post it once and never do it again. Who knows? You never know.
You never know. I hope we get Ryan drunk for that one if we ever do it. We get him 20 beers.
He'll have to go straight to the hard liquor. He'll have to go straight to the hard liquor. That's when the real Ryan comes out.
Yeah, we buy him the nicest bottle of whiskey that
$30
can buy.
I'm not buying him jack shit. He can get it himself. He has a fucking job.
That's true. He has a job.
Yes, and I
we make him buy the nicest bottle of whiskey that money can buy.
Yeah, we check. We go and see. My camera stopped working for a second. We get on a Discord call with him and make him go to the liquor store and pay the exorbitant New York tax.
Dude, and it's so funny because I've talked to him while he's like at a corner store or whatever, and I didn't know. So I'm like, I dropped like 5 N bombs, and I'm like mentioning Hitler, and he's like, I just want you to know I'm at a corner store and I don't have my earphones right now, so you're on loudspeaker.
I mean, listen, with the people that run
And he
those...
says it very casually, like he's not worried at all.
With the people that run those bodegas, I mean, they're the ones that are beating up black people for stealing.
It was so funny, dude.
That video of the 7-Eleven employees just beating a guy with a stick for trying to steal cigarettes. That's the kind of people, that's the stores he's frequenting. That's all you have in New York. That is all that exists in that shithole city.
That's true. I spent like 2 days there and that's...
Yeah, how was your trip there?
It was very... I spent most of my time in like the National Gallery and then the opera was very nice. I'll say this, the Met Opera was very nice.
Of course you went to the fucking opera. No wonder people think you're the gay friend.
Of course. Always, yeah. Yeah, between me and Grant, I'm the gay one always.
Yeah, just like on
those... Any Latino friend of Grant... The Latino friend is always the gay one.
Yeah, on the cover art of Contra Gentiles, everybody's always like, is Jeremy the gay one? Because
doesn't even need the... It's the V-neck, dude. It's not just the cover art.
It's not
art.
Just the V-neck. It's how he's standing there. He's like that, and his heel is raised
yes!
up.
Yeah,
the
it's glute. The heel. It's the chin, and it's the little raised heel. You're right.
Because Grant,
you're very right.
Grant is sitting there. Because
Grant's sitting there, yeah. Like, smoking a cigarette. He's like...
He's got the aesthetic down. He's got the aesthetic down. You
really
might
does.
Think that, yeah, maybe he's a little fruity, but this is a man who's laying pipe. And it's the complete opposite. It's the complete fucking opposite.
I mean, that doesn't even begin to describe it.
It's
more than the complete opposite. It's a different universe.
It is so astounding. It's so astounding. Because the heel. What was the stylistic choice of the heel? You're not getting taller off of Jeremy.
What is he, like 5'5"?
Average Peruvian height, I don't know. It's horrifying how short people are from that country.
Oh yeah, it's impressive.
It's not like we're two tall people talking about this.
No, I'm like 5'7".
Yeah, I'm 5'9". We go to Peru, we're giants.
Yeah, it's a little, it's like if I see a population shorter than me, like I feel embarrassed for them. Like, I'm sorry, I should be the shortest guy there. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, it's
what
strange.
What business do you have being shorter than me, man?
It's strange. It's like walking into the room being the smartest person. You're just disconcerted.
Yeah, that's Ryan's life every day in New York. He's somehow the smartest person there.
Well, I mean, you've seen the immigrant camps, man. It's no surprise.
Oh, yeah. About my trip to New York, I heard more foreign languages while just walking around than English, which was impressive.
I think English is
it was
forbidden in New York. Were you staying in Manhattan?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, that's why.
But Met Opera isn't.
That's why. Okay. Oh, yeah, no, dude. The last time I went to Manhattan, I haven't been there in, what year is it? 2-3 years? Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, about 3 years. I haven't been there in 3 years. And the last time I went, I was there with my girlfriend at the time. Mm-hmm. And we were walking through Manhattan. And I saw more Chinese people than even blacks.
Wow. Okay.
Especially because they travel in packs. You know, it's such a weird race of, like, hive-minded insect people.
Yeah, I didn't see that many blacks either. That's true.
But every black person I saw was either dressed like they were in a rap video. They had the puff jackets mm-hmm. and the ski masks
and everything. Yes.
Or they were a crack addict fighting themselves in the street.
I didn't see that many crack addicts this time. When I went in, like, in 2014... It was, like, the first person, like, when I got the taxi off the airport to go to the hotel, it was like, the first person was a crack addict.
Yeah.
Like, just passing by, skitzing out.
They're always skitzing out. I don't know what it is about crack that it gets to your mind like that, but they're, like, punching shadows and yelling at themselves.
Yeah, that was actually a very weird experience for me in, like, North America, because we have, like, our own drug and crime problems, but I never saw a guy skitzing out.
What even is the, like, what is the drug of choice in Brazil? Because I'm just imagining a whole country of weenos.
It's, like, mostly weed, dude. It really is.
Oh, that makes sense with the amount of blacks you have in that country.
Yeah, it really, really is.
Every, like, Brazilian athlete that comes out of
like,
Brazil.
Like, we have now. Crack. We have a place called Cracolândia, Cracklandia, where it's just, like, a bunch of crack houses, basically. But, like, they don't go to polite society because guards or police will just beat the shit out of you.
Based.
Like, or maybe kill you even by beating the shit out of you.
Based. Very based.
Yeah. And so, like, I don't see them around. Yet when I was in Canada, I was like, because I was studying there, my mom came to visit. I was, like, going to take her to a mall there. And, like, we were going to an entrance, and there was a guy skitzed out. I was like, well, I'm not bringing you in here. We're going to another place.
Yeah, no.
Because it was, like, literally everyone was giving him a wide berth. And I was like, this is unbelievable. Why isn't mall security, like, strangling this man?
Yeah, no, here in the Americas, we just do absolutely nothing about homeless
drug
addicts.
Yeah, that's shocking to me.
Absolutely. And then you have someone on Twitter recently that is like, they're not going to do anything to you. What are you scared of homeless people for? They're not going to do anything to you. Just leave them alone. And it's like, I mean, you're actually very likely to get attacked by a homeless person mm-hmm. if you get too fucking close.
Yeah, you are, man. And also, like, I don't know, I feel like even if you're skitzed out and if, like, I don't know, let's say you're so weak you're not afraid of anyone, you should still get the shit beaten out of you. Because you're skitzed out in public.
Yeah, you got crazy people. And crazy strength is a real fucking thing.
Yeah, that's true as well. Yeah, crazy yeah. I mean, doesn't Florida have, like, 10 stories per day of, like, a guy on crack fighting off 20 police officers while jacking off?
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, if we went through the Florida Man headlines, and there have been so many more. And we're getting, in Miami, we're getting spring breakers that don't actually go to college.
I mean, even our Florida friends, I guess, with you and Kate, are like, they're also crazy.
Yeah.
Like, of a rural Florida, you guys like, yeah, there was this gator there. And, like, every story I hear about Bartow and, like, fucking Caleb's encounters of homeless people, like, they're fairies off the woods which come and share a meal with him. And they... like, they're Tom Bombadil just gallivanting about. It's like, the fuck?
Yeah, he'll sit down and have a 30-minute conversation with a homeless guy about the Holocaust. It's like...
Yeah, my date stood me up, and I went to KFC. Or no, it wasn't KFC. He went to Publix. He got a Publix sandwich and shared it with a homeless guy and had a conversation with him about the Holocaust.
Yeah, and you know, we have some lucid homeless people in Miami. Because there are two distinctly different kinds of homeless people in Florida. So there's the ones that are like the fairies of the woods. And they're fine. Like, there's one that when I get off the highway here, at one of the exits I need to take to get home, he's always, he has a pair of headphones, and the way he raises money is dancing at the intersection. Okay. And he brings such good vibes that I'm like, fuck, I'm going to give you $5. Mm-hmm. I don't care what you do with this. You're entertaining. You're fun. You look great. You know, you got a smile on your face. You're disheveled.
Yeah.
You're dirty. I don't want to touch you, but man, you look like fun.
You're disgusting. If I touch you, you will give me leprosy, and I will die.
Yeah.
But
Yeah, no, I'm not touching you. But you look like a great time. You look like a fun person. So you get this money. Or there was one recently. I was walking to a 7-Eleven, and the guy's panhandling. And I tell him, sorry, I don't have any money. And he goes, okay, can you get me some food then? And I was, like, so jarred. Because normally these homeless people, they offer food to them. And they tell you no because they wanted that to go buy crack with. Mm-hmm. I was so jarred that I was like, all right, fuck it. Here's my charity for the day. I'll get you your food. I don't care. I got him his drink. I got him his Coke, a Coke, a pizza, and some Oreos. I was like, all right, fuck it. You actually want food? I'll get you food. I don't care. Because I legitimately didn't even have money on me.
Yeah.
I was just buying with his fucking debit card. I'm surprised these homeless people don't have card readers now.
I mean, I don't know if they're homeless, but there are people who panhandle here who... They're probably, yeah, they're almost definitely not homeless, because most of the people who panhandle here, you can tell when they're homeless or not by how disheveled they are. They're usually just people who don't want to work, but they will have a phone, and we have a thing called Pix here, where if you put in, like, usually their phone number or something, you can transfer, transfer
so
debit
like Venmo,
to debit.
Cash App.
Yeah, Venmo,
stuff.
Like that. Yeah, that's our equivalent. And so they were like, here's my Pix.
Can't you transfer
like,
money with WhatsApp?
I don't know. Like, I think you can, but we don't really use it.
It really confuses me, the third world obsession with WhatsApp.
I think it was just the first one that stuck.
Yeah.
And so, like, it just stuck.
It just is.
It just beat out all the others because of that.
It just is. But, yeah, one of the weirdest panhandling experiences I had, I was going into a supermarket, and there were some Jews outside. And, like, the really heavy religious kinds.
All right.
And they were selling CDs. So, basically, they were selling Jewish mixtapes. And it had, like, songs and Jewish preaching on it. And they were trying to sell it. I'm walking in there, and I'm going with my mom. And I just walk past anybody that asks me for money. I just walk past them. I don't care.
Yeah, that's what you should
She
do.
Stops.
Oh, no. First mistake.
She tells him that she doesn't have any money. The guy goes, we have Venmo.
That's so good, dude.
That's I was so just good. Like, why did you stop to talk to them?
Why would you stop to say we don't have money? Just walk past. That says it all.
Because she was, like, curious what they had, and then she didn't want it. So she was going to use the we don't have money, because she's too polite to say I'm not interested.
To say no thanks.
Like, I'm not that polite. I will say that. I will say I'm not interested. Like, you should see when people, because I get a lot of business calls. And to total flex, of course. You get a lot of business calls.
Yes.
And half of them are going to be people trying to sell us shit. And I just tell them straight up, I'm not interested. And there was one guy that started trying to argue with me to try and close the deal. And I just keep telling him, I'm not interested. I'm not in. And he keeps going. Are you sure? But he's done blah, 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 blah. I'm like, I'm not interested. And he keeps going. So eventually I start cutting him off. And I tell him, like, guy, stop. I work in sales. And you know what happens if somebody tells me no? I stop. You're not going to make the fucking sale like this.
Yeah.
He starts arguing with me. I'm like, these people are fucking insane.
Yeah, they really
are. People
are
fucking
they.
Insane.
Just psychopath gene, dude. It's incredible. People go on and on.
How do you work in sales? Like, I hate making phone calls, man. I hate fucking making phone calls. I'll talk to somebody in person. I got no problem talking to somebody in person.
Yeah.
I hate phone calls. And you get these people here that their job all day is to make phone calls. I would think you're relieved when most of the people tell you no. No. They keep fucking going.
Yeah, it's crazy because they must be paid by commission or something. You'd think they know, like, okay, I gotta manage my time here and get, like, okay, this guy's not interested. Gotta go to the next guy or whatever.
Oh, they're just, oh yeah, let me keep going. I really push. If I
he
really
one
push.
Phone number he knew, and he was like, I don't have another client, man. You need to buy this. I don't know any other phone numbers. They just gave me this one thing.
Yeah, you're my last hope, man. I'm going to starve if you don't buy this. Like, okay, fucking starve. I don't care. Go to the church.
He really should have gone with that one. He really should have gone with it. I have 10 kids, dude. If I don't close this deal, they're going to die by tomorrow.
I don't know, man. Go to the fucking food bank.
I'll kill them myself. Like,
go to the food bank.
Crazy.
Go to the church. Get some charity there. I'm running a business here. All right? Do you see Catholic Church painted on our fucking door? No, you don't. No, you fucking don't. So how about you go somewhere else with your bullshit?
Yeah, when he goes to, if he ever tries to go to a synagogue for help with food, we'll also say, I'm running a business here. What do you think this is, a charity?
Well, you know, actually, something really funny. You're going to love this. So on the high holidays, at every Jewish service, you read a little portion from the Torah. And you do this on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. But on the high holidays, there's a Torah portion for every prayer session. And in a lot of synagogues, so not only in like Reform and Conservative synagogues, do you need to buy a ticket to go on the holidays. In most synagogues, they will have auctions for who gets called up to the altar for the certain portions of, because they'll split it up. Where, like, you have different people from the congregation come up. They don't read it. You have somebody else reading it. But they come up and they stand there for those few portions while the guy reads it. And they auction this off. Like, you have to pay the synagogue after the holiday for going up there to have the portion read.
Dude, I don't even understand that mindset. Like,
it's donations.
I can't.
It's donations.
Dude, just like... Jews are just so allergic to, like, donating, but if you just pass, like, the donation basket, like, in a Catholic church or whatever, they won't give it. But if you offer them a ticket, they're like, yes, yes, I will buy the ticket.
Yeah, there has to be a service rendered!
Yes, there has to be a service rendered.
How, that's so funny. My Jewish mind can't comprehend, what's this, charity? Charity? Is that going to Israel? Oh no, I gotta buy a portion from the Torah. It's so insane, like, you're auctioning to read the, and they're not even reading it?
I don't get that. There must be some, like, theological significance, because there's no fucking way to, like, standing up in front, I don't know, there's God.
There's none! There's none! What's the point? What is the difference? Because it's not like a biblical commandment. It's not like it's a biblical commandment.
It's got to be something in the Talmud, dude.
In the Talmud, sure, but in the Bible, the actual Bible, because, newsflash, there was no written Bible in the time of the Israelites. So it's not like it's in the Bible to say, read the Bible when you go to the Great Temple for service.
Yeah, it's not there.
It's not there. So in reality, all it is... They just, in some attempt to legitimize the modern Jewish religion, they were like, what can we do? What can we do? All right, how about we have a Torah reading? And then you have your Torah reading, and they're like, oh, but the community is not engaged with it. They're not showing up. We don't have our minions for our congregation. What do we do? And then they were like, oh, Shmuley, I have a great idea. So what do we do? What we're going to do is we're going to call up a lucky person to come up and read the Torah with us. And I'm sure at some point they were actually getting up there and reading it. But now your average Jew is so fucking disconnected from everything that they have no idea what to read when they get up there. They don't know how to read that shit.
Yeah, and it's all in Hebrew, I assume.
It's all in Hebrew. They don't put it in English. And there's no, like, in the Hebrew alphabet, you have little punctuations called nekudot that help you determine, like, what the intonation is, how the vowel is supposed to sound, because there's no actual vowels. So there's nekudot.
Yeah, I remember that.
Okay. The Torah is not allowed to have that. There's some Talmudic stuff like, oh, no, only the letters can be written, because there's no nekudot in ancient Israel.
Uh-huh.
So it can only be the letters. So, yeah, they don't know. You have to actually, like, practice it. That's why, kids with bar mitzvah, they have to practice for like a year memorizing how to read the Torah, because it's supposed to have like a song to it.
Yeah.
So they gotta practice that for like a year. So yeah, your average person has no idea. You throw them in there, like, hey, read this. Well, they're not gonna do it the way that's supposed to, quote unquote, be done. So yeah, it's now we're just at a point where, okay, so you call them up to do nothing, just to stand there. Somebody else reads it for them. And then on the holy days, it's supposed to be such a big honor that you auction it off so it's fair. And I mean, does that sound fair to you? Because I think a raffle sounds more fair. Mm-hmm. Put some names into big hats yeah. they wear and pull it out? No.
Yeah, that'd be more fun. More community spirit, I suppose.
Too. Yeah, how about we just make it bingo? Really, really nail down the Boca Raton yeah. vibe yeah. and yeah. make it fucking yeah. bingo.
Make a bingo, dude. That'd be awesome.
B 6 million. Oh, that's me. That's me.
Well, I haven't read the Talmud, but I don't think it has any commentary on bingo. It's gotta be. It's gotta be kosher.
How does the fucking Talmud keep coming up in these episodes, man? How does the Talmud keep coming up?
I mean, we're talking about the Jews. Like, surely.
I know, but my God, dude. And I just, some parts of me wish the Talmud was as interesting as that portion where they say Christ is boiling and yeah, shouldn't see.
Yeah, no. Because
at least
that's just
something.
The highlight. Yeah,
at
least
that's
the
something.
Claim. That's,
the rest of it is just. It's like, do you have any interest in, like, sitting through a legal journal? No.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it sounds like to me.
It's so boring. It's so fucking boring. Like, what if, is it a sin if you fall off a cliff and a twig takes your pants off and you land in a woman's vagina but you're not married to her? Was that sinful? It's like, because that's the beauty of Catholicism. Like, there are a lot of questions of the what if, because you need to address the what ifs.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a hard line on what sin is, and it sort of has to be intention and action.
Uh-huh.
So it's very simple. Like, you don't actually overthink it that much. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not getting into Mormon soaking territory.
Yeah. And, like, not only that, there's, like, a mechanism for examination of conscience. Where it's, like, if you don't know something is a sin, it actually doesn't really count. Because you don't intend it to be a sin.
Yeah.
You're, like, if you think it's, like, good, you have been deceived. Or you were willfully ignorant or whatever. But if you weren't, it's like, okay. There's also, in confession, it's like, okay, I can just go to confession. And then, like, if something isn't a sin, but I think it's a sin, because I don't know, I don't want to read the catechism or whatever, I'll say it. And then my priest will be like, oh, that's not a sin, by the way, or whatever, at the end of it.
That's a nice little filtering mechanism.
Yeah, it's like, it's fine. You could just say whatever you want to the priest. The priest will, you know, you'll finish the rite. Then at the end, I've had this happen to me. He'll say, by the way, that one probably, like... Maybe at max venial, but even then, depending on the intention, not sure. You probably just felt slightly bad about something.
Yeah, it's and there is something to, like, the ignorance part that Jews do have. Like, there's some approximation of it. But then that's how you get into, like, the really Talmudic things of, like... That's where you start getting into loopholes. Because mm-hmm. we all know about the Shabbos elevators and the Shabbos boys and all that shit.
Yeah, that's so funny, dude.
But that's one side of the coin. The mm-hmm. other side of the coin is the really, really strict, like, Pharisee behavior of, mm-hmm. no, you have to avoid this because then it might lead entirely to someone else getting confused and causing a sin. So that's, like, that's where you get into, like I told you about, like, the crumb of bread in your house on Passover. And that's why Jews can't have chicken parmesan.
Yeah.
Because... Now, we can go over that portion in Leviticus. It says, thou shalt not cook a calf in its mother's milk.
Uh-huh.
Now, I was not raised on a farm. You know, I don't have too much experience with livestock personally. But what I do uh-huh. know is chickens don't produce milk.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So, in reality,
no cloacal milk.
How can you cook a chicken in its mother's milk if they don't produce milk? But no, the reasoning is mm-hmm. that, oh, well, someone might see you eating a chicken parmesan. And they might see that because the chicken is meat and the cheese is dairy, that, oh, well, actually, they can eat a cheeseburger. Because then they're going to think, and it's like, no, chicken is very distinct to steak. Because then they allow a tuna really melt. You can mix fish with cheese. Because it's so distinct to beef that no one's going to confuse it. But uh-huh. chicken is similar to beef?
That's... I had forgotten that. Yeah, you told me about that 1 year and 1 day ago.
And then on Passover, Sephardic Jews are allowed to eat rice and chickpeas. But Ashkenazi Jews aren't.
What the fuck? I didn't know
because
that
they
one.
Might confuse it for one of the five grains that's forbidden on Passover. And I think that it can eat, and it's like, no, chickpeas don't look like wheat. rice doesn't look like wheat. No one's making rice flour unless you're Chinese.
The Chinese Jewish community.
There is. That does exist. That does exist.
I'm sure it does. I'm sure.
And it's an old one, too.
I'm sure.
It's over in the desert portion, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, that's where they... I mean, yeah, because, like, one of the... Like, because there was an ancient Christian Chinese sect that was wiped out. But, like, it basically means, like, the Jews knew about fucking China because one of the apostles went there.
Yeah.
Possibly Thomas on his way to India or whatever, past India, I don't know.
Yeah, no, there is something very weird there. And then, but also if you look into the article on Wikipedia of Chinese Jews, you'll get that community. But then you also get the guy that started all the casinos in Macau is half Dutch and is Jewish from that side.
Uh-huh.
So the current heiress of all the casinos in Macau is Jewish, even though she's Chinese.
Of course
you can. You come full circle here. You come full circle too. There's this ancient sect of maybe like 10,000 Chinese Jews that have been there for like 1,500 years.
Uh-huh.
But then on the other end, the guy that started all the casinos, also Jewish.
Also Jewish. Completely unrelated.
Entirely.
Like... yeah.
Entirely unrelated.
Beautiful, just an amazing world we live in.
The duality.
The duality of man.
But on a completely unrelated topic, because I really do tire of talking about Jews. Not just because I come from the background, but just because it's such a boring fucking topic.
Yeah, they're not that interesting unless you have a good Jew joke.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Like, unless you come with some crazy thing that the Jews have done.
I will say, I will never get tired of the clip of seeing a Jewish man climb out of a grave in New York with his, like, hat still on perfectly.
Him and Vile Shlomo.
Vile Shlomo! Dude, I looked that up yesterday to make sure I didn't hallucinate.
It's Vile Shlomo.
It's Vile!
And his nose!
And it's like, he's like this, and I'm gonna be honest, he kind of looks like the Jewish version of Giga Chad, where he's, like, looking out over his conquered domain in, like, the West Bank, or whatever. He's on LinkedIn, dude! It's the same guy, you can see his picture, it's just, like, full frontal, except from the side.
Was talking to, like, he took his Palestinian neighbor's house, and she's all pissed because they knew each other for years, and she thought they were in good conditions, and he's like, well, if I don't take it, someone else is gonna take it.
It's like, this is such a Jewish... Real Vile Shlomo behavior.
But, the other topic, so what we talk about a lot when we're not playing D&D is we do talk a lot. If someone wants to go through our Discord DMs, it's almost all just talking about books.
Uh-huh, yeah.
We are both very avid readers of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting ones is you were there with me. So for the people that don't know, which will be pretty much everybody because I never talk about this, I dropped the ball on reading Lord of the Rings for a very long time. I started the Fellowship when I was maybe 15, 16. And because of Tolkien's writing style, I never got too far into it. I got maybe 100-something pages. So I got to the part where they get out of the Shire and run into the Black Riders. And that's where I stopped for almost 10 years.
All right.
So you've been there with me for the journey of actually sitting down to finish the trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a lot of thoughts about Lord of the Rings. And and not just from us, of course. Like, it is one of the most seminal books of the Western canon.
Oh, yeah. Dude. It's like, I open it up because I haven't read in like a few years. So I open it up to like a random page the other day. And it's the part, it's in Return of the King, where Gandalf, Éomer, and Aragorn are discussing Eowyn's love for like her time in, not Helm's Deep. What's the name of the Rohan's
city? I just read it. Why do I not remember that?
Yeah. Holy shit. Whatever. Yeah, where Gandalf uses the line to hutch the tram a wild thing in, which is like how he was discussing how Wormtongue talked about like kind of persuaded her, and this thing is like out of the movie, which I had completely forgotten because I watched the movie like last week, where like Gandalf says that if she had not kept quiet, you would have heard much similar words from Wormtongue and from Eowyn.
Is that Return of the King or is that Two Towers? I think that's Two Towers.
I There might be two towers. In the book where they talk, where they steal some of those lines, it's two towers. In the movie, I mean. In the book, I think it was Return of the King, because it was a random page. It was like, I read the last paragraph again, which has the best last line in all of fiction. It's just like, so good, well, I'm back, is just iconic. But also, dude, it's such an amazing paragraph. But this slide where Aragorn is like discussing why Eowyn loves her, thinks she loves him.
Yes, okay, that is a shadow. Yeah.
Yeah, and he says it's but a in me she loves a shadow and a thought. She loves the idea of glory in distant lands far from the fields of Rohan. And, like, it's like, dude, I didn't know, I forgot Aragorn was a fucking penetrating psychologist here all of a sudden. Like,
poetry.
He just, like, instantly, like, seriously, he just, like, knows. But, like, even Denethor speaks like this. I open it to another, like, page, like, to see the conversation between Gandalf and Denethor. Like, everyone speaks in this very old Norse cadence that I find really pleasing, although I understand why, like, 16-year-old you, like, 16-year-old me didn't fucking like it at the beginning. It was only after I read The Hobbit and then I could read The Lord of the Rings. But, like, man, it's, like, all the dialogue just feels perfect.
It does. It
Holy
does.
Shit.
And it's not that I didn't like it at 16. It's just there is a sort of level of literary maturation that you have to go to read it. Because The Hobbit,
so
of course, is
so
a children's
real.
Book. It was written intended
yes.
to be a children's book. So it's much easier to digest. When you get into Lord of the Rings trilogy and get into his other writings, it is the writing of modern mythology. So yeah, of course,
yeah.
Like, you're not just reading a story, because that's what some people get wrong. Like, we were talking about that with Grant the other day, a few weeks back. I don't think you were there, where I recommended Lord of the Rings to him, and he said that he doesn't really like fantasy and all that and those sorts of books. And I explained to him, they're like, yeah, it's fantasy, but it's really mythology, because what throws
yes.
a lot of people off is it's not writing about some fictional land that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
It is, but not like a fictional mm-hmm. world. It's a prehistory.
Yes.
It's written
yes.
entirely intended to be a prehistory. And that makes it a little dry. Like, I can understand there was that guy a few weeks ago that called it overrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have respected him more if he said, I just don't enjoy it.
Yes. I don't think it's overrated at all.
It's not. It's 100%. Because
it is, weirdly enough, the greatest Norse saga ever written. It's, like you said, we had this conversation about Snow Crash, because I haven't read it yet, and I was asking questions about it. And you said Stephenson wrote the genre killer for cyberpunk, and we discussed what a genre killer is in cyberpunk and whatever. But what interests me was, I was reflecting on this the other day, but, like, the genre killer for Norse sagas was written, like, 1,000 years after they stopped being written by John Ronald Reuel Tolkien. That was the genre killer for Norse sagas.
You would think that the genre killer of Norse sagas was in
Beowulf,
1100, 1200.
Yeah.
No, it was in the 1940s. And while simultaneously being the Norse saga killer, it was the progenitor of fantasy.
Because
by definition, Lord of the Rings cannot be overrated, because every fantasy is either directly or indirectly inspired by Lord of the Rings. Even when you get into something like Dune. Like, we were talking about Dune with Caleb.
Mm-hmm.
And Herbert was an admirer of Tolkien. Herbert was indirectly inspired by Tolkien. It just so happened that Herbert's entire life philosophy is the antithesis of Tolkien, so he ended up writing the antithesis of Tolkien. Now, I haven't read Dune yet, but from what everyone has told me and from everything I've heard from people like you, like Noam, is that, Dune is the anti-loader. Like,
yeah,
it just is. And
there
I find
that things to appreciate about Dune, but you can, like, there are things that that you can very much take the opposite message from what the author intends, but there, you can clearly tell what he's trying to say and what his philosophy is behind it.
Yeah. Yeah, because, of course, everybody has that thing, like, if you read and watch Starship Troopers.
Yeah. If it's a good work of art. If it's a bad work of art, that's not possible and it should be thrown in the trash.
Yes.
But if it's a good work of art, it can do that, where the man has some skill as an artist, and I think Herbert was actually very talented in that regard.
No, there's definitely, I haven't read it yet, but I will eventually get to it. But there is something there, because it doesn't become a cultural phenomenon the way that these books do. Because that's part of it, the staying power of it. Because any book can become a cultural phenomenon. any book can do that. Hunger Games was a cultural phenomenon. Do we
Twilight.
Say Twilight? Yeah. Do we say that these books have any staying power? That, not really. Harry Potter, for all its flaws, has staying power.
Yes, it actually it really does, because I think Harry Potter is a genre killer, not for like sorcery urban fantasy books, but for kind of like these children academia novels,
young fantasy, young fiction.
Yeah, but for specifically like the in school like novel for children.
Yeah,
because that's like there's many novels like that. Like Harry Potter probably is like the you aren't gonna top this.
Yeah, I can only think of one book that really survives in that genre post Harry Potter or book series, and that's the Percy Jackson series.
I've only read one of those books. It was one of my friends gave me, and he really liked it when I was like 15, and it was like fine.
Yeah, no, they were fine. I read when I was like 10, 11 years old. I was reading them cover to cover over and over again. Like they were good books, but it's really the only one I can think of that within the young fantasy, young fiction realm. And it still doesn't, as much as it aggrieved me as a 10-year-old, it doesn't touch Harry Potter. And I still haven't read Harry Potter, but I can recognize, and I still don't like Harry Potter, because I think it has been a cultural negative.
A cultural death.
But it does have the staying power, so I have to give it the respect that it deserves for that, at least. But yeah, somebody like Herbert, I know going into it that I'm going to disagree with a lot from that book. But that it does have messages you can take out of it. Just like Starship Troopers, you compare, because the book, it's very clear-cut. Like, this is, what's it? Heinlein was a man that was inspired by whatever woman he was fucking at the time.
It's actually surprising, like, all of his big books, like, okay, maybe he was fucking other women as well, but they were all written with his wife, who he apparently dearly, not with his wife, but while he was married, with his wife, whom he apparently dearly loved, but he might have fucked other women
he
at
had,
the time.
So he had a lot of, before he met his wife, he had a lot of different phases.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
I thought Starship, I think all the ones I read from, was Starship Troopers written before?
Starship Troopers was one of his later books, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, okay. That's
and
why.
That's
only
where,
read his later
and
ones.
So that's where he gets into his wife, and that's his stability era. And that's where you see that he starts musing with these ideas of, like, strict order within society, duty, militarism, those sorts of things. Because, like, the moon is a harsh mistress. I actually have to look into that, which came after, because I think the moon is a harsh mistress came after. And that would have been after his wife, I believe, because he was not married just once.
Yeah, it was 1966.
Yeah, so Starship Troopers comes before that. Starship Troopers was written in the 50s. And he was married three times. So 1929, 1930, 1932, 1947, and then his last wife in 1948.
Yeah, I only know of a last wife because that's the one he met during the war, I think.
Yeah, so he had a lot of different phases. And something like Starship Troopers is very unmistakable for the message it's giving off. You get someone like Paul Verhoeven, then, who is a dirty, faggy communist.
Yes.
And he hates that. He hates Heinlein. He did Starship Troopers, the movie, just to fuck with Heinlein's legacy. And what does he do? Inadvertently creates right-wing propaganda.
Yeah, he cements Heinlein's legacy amazingly, actually. He creates better Heinlein propaganda than Heinlein does.
Yeah. So it's really, like, that's where you get into these things where, yeah, you can take a separate message from it. Because I know, like, the idea behind the first Book of Dune is, like, oh, don't trust a messianic figure, religion is there to control you, etc., etc.
Yeah, but the problem with the first... Okay, if I discuss this, I'll get into spoilers. But yes, continue.
But, yeah, getting back to it is that you can't call Tolkien overrated, because Tolkien is the progenitor of all fantasy. Like, I even messaged you... And the scene in Shelob's lair.
Where
Samwise pulls out the file from Galadriel.
Yes.
And it's like, well, okay, yeah, that is where one of our favorite series, the Dresden Files.
Yes.
Gee, I wonder where Butcher got the idea for a glowing amulet that carries like a holy light to it. Gee, I wonder where that came from.
Yeah, and Butcher loves, like, he's gone on record multiple times, he loves Lord of the Rings.
And you can't avoid, Dungeons & Dragons is so inextricably tied to Lord of the Rings.
It's a party going out adventuring into the mines of Moria. It's like that section 500 times, getting bigger and bigger until you save the world or whatever.
Yeah, you can't separate the modern fantasy genre from Tolkien. But one of the things I think a lot of people really, their surface level understanding of Tolkien that annoys the shit out of me, that you'll see serious, quote unquote serious, thinkers like on YouTube and online and all that, like blog writers, video makers, all that, good versus evil.
Oh my god.
I despise that so much. Because yeah, I guess it's easier going into it with understanding like the Catholic framework.
Uh-huh.
That, yes, this is more than just a story of good versus evil. Because then that's like going, the Bible is a story of good versus evil.
Yeah.
In some loose like sense, in some loose sense, you're correct.
Yes.
In a very loose sense.
If I had to describe it in three words, I suppose good versus evil is as good as any other three
Even
words.
Then, I would say story of salvation.
Yeah, story of salvation, yeah. Because
yeah, then you're going to get into the philosophy of it, like, does evil even exist?
Exactly.
Is evil actually a possibility? And not really. And this is, like, this does become part of a blight to the fantasy genre of the baseline understanding. Like, the good writers
will at least intuit.
Because then you get into, oh, Game of Thrones versus Lord of the Rings. One's about gray morality, and one's about, well, no, morality is gray morality, because there's no...
Yeah, when Frodo's being tempted by the ring, or even, like, Gollum, who was once just a hobbit. And like even when you get to any of the figures that are tempted by the ring, or even the kings of men who became the Nazgul, it's like, even Sauron, dude! Fucking Sauron! It's like, he wasn't, like, immediately evil.
Sauron was an angel, like, you're getting there into...
Saruman! Saruman is actually a great example, where we don't see... His corruption, or the process of his corruption on screen in the book. But, like, he's a great, like, where Gandalf's, like, shocked. He's like, you're Saruman the White. What the fuck is happening here? And he becomes Saruman the Gay, the Wizard of Many Colors.
He does.
That's so funny.
Wow, that's topical.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it's so frustrating, because then, I understand if your average person who's not too deep into literature and philosophy and all that takes away with that reading. Because, okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm. This is not your specialty. You're not interested in these things. And it's a fine takeaway as a surface level reading.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're someone who purports to think deeper about it, and you're making even just short, because like I saw a short about it on YouTube, comparing Game of Thrones to Lord of the Rings and talking about the morality of Tolkien in a YouTube short. And of course, you can't get into it in a YouTube short.
Yeah, you can't.
So it's a stupid idea to start with, but it's really lead to his video essay about it.
Yes, yes.
Where he goes deeper into it. But even then, the majority of the 60 seconds is focused on the good versus evil, with no hint that there might be more to it.
It's even more accurate to say, if we're going to use three words, good versus corruption.
Yes.
Or good against that which is corrupt. It's something like that, where you don't... Like, even like one of the reasons I really like Wheel of Time, and I think why Wheel of Time is like one of the famous fantasy series, nowhere close to Lord of the Rings, but why it achieved the respect it is amongst fantasy fans, is because it actually understands that. Because at the beginning, you don't think it does, if you just read the first book. But as you go on, and you really understand the nature of the evil he set up, and you realize it doesn't really have anything of its own. Like, everything is just a corruption of things. You're like, okay, Robert Jordan at least got this.
Yeah,
I don't know if he was a Christian, but, like, it makes sense if he was.
Yeah, there's things that he can intuit. Like, going back to the Dresden Files. The deeper you get into the series, the better it is.
Yes, holy
and there's a reason,
shit.
Like, we constantly talk about it. Like, we don't know. Like, yes, Butcher comes from a Christian background. We don't know what
if
kind
he is.
Or
practicing or...
Yeah, if he's practicing, if he comes from a Catholic background or a Baptist background or what it is. Mm-hmm. But you tell that there's something there. Because the deeper you get into the books, the morality is quote-unquote gray. But that's because it gets more complex. Because you understand how these things go. Like, when you get to, I think it's the end of Battlefield. Or, no, Battleground. When you get to the end of Battleground. And Mab tells Harry, I was human once, too.
Yes, dude, such a good moment.
Or 15 or 17 books at that point
I think it's 15 or 16. It's something
like
that.
It's one
of those. It's 16. It's 17. It's 17.
You're 17. Skin books Game was 15. And you've seen this character so many times, and you think she's a cold blooded, literally just because she's inhuman, because she's a fairy, that she's this cold blooded, evil thing that abides by her only. Her only justification will be that the fairy have to abide by strict legalism. Mm-hmm. And then you get to that point, and you see, I was human once too.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly your whole perception of this character for 17 books is torn apart.
I remember I had this moment with Nicodemus in Skin Game where he basically sacrifices his daughter for something, but she goes like completely willingly.
Yes.
And like he actually has a twisted sense of love for her, and he only sacrifices her because he believes it's the right thing to do because he believes his aims are righteous. Like, I forget what if he says a line, but it's something like, I don't know if it's just for freedom, if he just hates God because he thinks... I don't remember what it was, but
it's
just
something
so
along those
good.
Lines.
It
is something
along something those lines. It's
something like that. Yeah.
And, like, it recontextualizes why this character is doing... Like, he doesn't see himself as evil. He just... Like, he... Compared to the other, his entourage of, like, demons, he's, like... He only tortures when he needs to, or to send a message. And of course, he hates his enemies because he's filled with hate. But that's it. Like, he just wants to get the job done because his cause is righteous. And his enemies are bad.
And that's how you make an interesting evil character. Because you can make a character that's just flat out evil. Mm-hmm. You can. And it can work. It's not going to be too deep, but it can work. But then on the other end, you don't want to make a character too sympathetic. Aesthetic as evil, because then you're sort of justifying what they do. But there's this sweet spot where you just understand what makes a bad person, and some of them are mm-hmm. just, you know, broken and corrupt, and they're prone to doing these things, and that's a perfectly feasible character to write. Mm-hmm. On the other end, there is the delusion, because we all understand literally the saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
I mean, Gollum is actually one of the best examples of a corrupted character, because he's like basically a drug addict. Like, yeah. I think, which is shocking to me. I don't know how many drug addicts, like, Tolkien met. But, like, man, he's really got them down to a T.
He does. That
Holy
is your average New York crackhead.
Shit. Yeah.
Talks to himself, has arguments with himself.
Full circle. Back to the beginning of the
backstabs you.
It really is, like, my precious. That's all I can think of. It's like this... This putting of its lower good, it's not even, I mean, the ring is barely a good, but like putting it above anything else, where it's just like this one thing, everything is about this one thing and nothing else. It's great.
And
it's like, yeah, good. And this good versus evil misunderstanding has kind of spawned, because I read a bunch of other fantasy novels, that kind of spawned that people view the world in a dualistic way.
Yes.
Where there is a good force and an evil force, and they're, like, in opposition, and then, you know, they flip or whatever. I think Glenn Cook kind of does this in The Black Company, which is actually really well written, but even then, like, it's got a few problems. Or is it? It's maybe another series, but, it's like where, you know, every 100 or 1,000 years, like, it's the Age of Light, and then it's the Age of Dark, and it's whatever. I think Zelda does this, I might be wrong, but they have, like, ages or whatever. It's like, it's this very, it's this wrong-headed idea, in a way.
It
where
is,
there is an active evil force as pure evil.
And it really does, like, degrade the quality of a story for me. Because,
yeah,
even, like, when you understand, is Satan purely evil? No, of course not.
Yeah, actually, no.
Of course
Saint
not.
St. Augustine outright says no. The demons can't be purely evil. They wouldn't exist otherwise.
No, and that's what's really interesting about Tolkien's work, is that when you actually analyze it, are even the orcs pure evil? No.
Yeah, even, like, Tolkien is even, like, very, like, like, I showed you that letter he wrote mm-hmm. to someone who actually asked. It might have been a priest friend, if I remember correctly. Was asking about the ontological status of orcs. And, like, he was like, I'm not comfortable with saying they're irredeemably evil. Like, he actually writes in, like, between, in parentheses. Like, I had to stop myself from saying irredeemably after he writes they're evil. It was like, he kind of hesitates to even say that. Because if they're sentient, they can't be irredeemable. If they're not, like, you know, these pure spirits who make an eternal choice, and his angels aren't exactly like Atva angels in the real world. So he's like kind of like reticent to say it. So he kind of gets the interpretation you had, where they're kind of animals, really.
Yeah, they're very animalistic. Like they're barely sentient animals because they argue amongst each other, but they operate entirely off primal drive. Like it's what would happen mm-hmm. if you gave a monkey the level of intelligence of a human.
Yeah, they wouldn't be able to be baptized.
Yeah.
Because there's actually been, like, a Catholic priest who, like, wrote about if we find, like, what are the categories for baptizing alien races if we ever find them in the next, like, billion years or whatever. And, like, there's a bunch of, like, I forget what they all were, but, like, basically orcs wouldn't be in them. Like, even if they have language or whatever, orcs just can't be in them.
No. And even then, like, really, the driving force, like we were talking about earlier with what qualifies a sin, is there has to be intention mm-hmm. to a sin. You have to want to do it. Even if you don't actively realize that it's a sin, there has to be intention to it. And you can't qualify the orcs under that category because they didn't choose to be orcs. They didn't volunteer. Mm-hmm. They were a corruption, an invention.
Mm-hmm. So these weren't... can't choose otherwise. They can only follow their nature.
Yeah, these weren't humans and elves that woke up one day and were like, yes, Sauron, yes, Saruman, turn us into orcs. No, uh-huh. they were taken and forcibly corrupted and their nature was destroyed. So another way you could look at it is these are almost like undead.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was about to say, I think a good way to see is that whatever they were before was killed. Like, it's not the same person. It's something using its body. And yeah. It's like capacity for language.
Yeah,
so it can speak, it can do whatever, but it's like, it's just, it's reanimated, but it doesn't have a real rational soul in it. Maybe an animal one at best.
Yeah. Can you baptize a zombie? No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good, yeah, orcs are just cooler zombies.
Pretty much.
They can have swords.
Yeah. And even then, they're not purely evil. Because they're just like animals. Gollum, not purely evil. How many times is he spared throughout the story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And what's Gandalf's like? My favorite line from Fellowship is when Gandalf, when he talks about mercy and Gollum. When I was about to say Fredo.
Fredo? Fredo. Yeah, when Christopher, what's the fucking name? My God, what are their names?
Who?
The former governor of New York.
Christopher Cuomo.
Cuomo, yeah. When Chris Cuomo takes the ring.
Was carrying the ring to Mordor. What's his height? How tall is he?
He's tall, I think.
Oh, he's tall. I was hoping he was like 5'4", so he could be a little hobbit. Imagine.
No, Andrew. Andrew looks like the short one. Chris Cuomo height. 6'2".
Oh, damn. Yeah, he'd have to take the role of Gandalf.
Andrew's 5'11", so he's in the 5-foot gang. Maybe he can be...
He's in the 5-foot gang! Reimagining those movies of the Cuomo brothers. Trying to do, like, the accents. The sort of, like, neutral English cadence that they all went for.
He can't help... Well, he can't help wanting the ring. He's Italian.
Got him! Got him!
Got him! Pussy! Pussy! Give me the pussy! Give me the pussy! Yes! Yes! Yes, Staffa! Staffa, give pussy! Yes!
Got him! Got him!
Got him!
That's...
Andrew! Andrew!
Which one of them has nipple rings again?
I don't fucking know!
Because I remember seeing a video of him, like, talking to the camera, and it was very clear for the shirt.
Christ
dude.
Alive, was, probably like, Andrew. I don't. He's the one who got in trouble for the sex shit.
Oh, was he? I thought both of them did.
No, Chris lost his job for supporting his brother, which, I mean, is that
like,
really
what the fuck,
a job worth losing or worthy offense? Like, say what you will about the Cuomo brothers, but they stand up for family.
Yeah, I actually find him slightly more admirable now.
Yeah.
It was my job, but I'll sit
for
him.
If I had a sibling that got fired for allegedly doing something, because it wasn't even rape. It was like...
For being a little Italian around women.
Yeah, if I had a brother who was in trouble for being a little Italian around women, I would stand up for him too. That's my fucking brother. Mm-hmm. You want me to throw him under the bus? We're family, especially if you're Italian.
Yeah,
you're You're expecting Italian Americans to throw their family under the bus? You don't know Italians.
Dude, that's
don't
insane,
know Italians.
But when Gandalf says it was Mercy that stayed Bilbo's blade, and you don't know what could be the effects of that, when Frodo says Bilbo should have killed him.
Yeah.
It's like this. It's so. I forget
what my
original
point is. And there's a million times. There's a million times that Sam wants to kill Frodo. And he has so many chances. And then even then.
Sam?
Yeah.
Kill Frodo?
No.
I was like, dude, are you sure you read
oh my god, I almost just said Bilbo. What the hell?
Dude, everyone wants to kill Frodo. Bilbo,
Sam,
Mary
Pippin.
Sam
wants to kill Gollum. Oh my god.
Yeah, there's several scenes where they try to kill him, Sam behind his back, but he just bends down and picks something up and they trip over him. Behind the knife behind their back.
What a way to ruin the story. Yeah, Sam actually wants to kill. We've had people trying to ruin the story saying Sam wants to fuck Frodo. No.
That would be the hot take of Lord of the Rings, is Sam secretly hates Frodo and wants to kill him.
Yeah, all those times he's ready to fucking kill himself because he thought Frodo died. No. He did it because he's secretly waiting for his downfall. He was sad that somebody else killed Frodo. That's what it was.
That's so funny.
When Sam wants to kill Gollum.
Yes.
And Frodo tells him no, and it gets to a point where even the conscience starts to climb into Sam when he has the opportunity. He even sees that, the real suffering is this guy living the way he does.
Yeah.
There's a mercy to it, and there's a punishment to it. Mm-hmm. And and this is what bothers me so much of that, it's good versus evil. No, even Sauron can be redeemed if he so chose to be.
Yeah.
But he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, he suffers the same fate that Satan did not have to rebel in heaven. He mm-hmm. could have repented. And what is his punishment for it? Well, now he is truly the damned.
Yeah, now he's as far from God as he got what he wanted. He's as free as he could possibly be.
And the same thing for Sauron. That, he got what he wanted. The ring returned to Mordor. And it got thrown into Mount Doom, because same with Satan. Even though it's really, Melkor would be the Satan character, and Sauron
Morgoth.
Is a high
Morgoth,
demon.
Morgoth gets his ass kicked, 10 times in the Silmarillion, so Sauron ends up looking more threatening at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's really funny. But even then, you can still draw the Satan allegory to Sauron.
Yeah, you can. Because Sauron is the evil force. He's the tempter. He's the ring is his. It's not Morgoth's. And that's the big symbol for temptation in the story is the ring.
Because the ring technically can be used for good. It's just that nobody's going to resist the temptation in the long run.
Yeah.
You can use it to build a utopia, and then you're just going to end up in the same way. This is, and that's the driving force, is that the ring itself is not evil.
I mean, Boromir is such a wonderfully complex character.
Oh my god.
Because what he says at the Council of Rivendell, and he's like, look, I've spent my, if you know me, I spent my entire life fighting the armies of Mordor. I risk my life every day on the front lines to do this. Give us the ring. It's a weapon. We can finally use it against the enemy and turn the tide. Don't fucking throw it away. Don't do it on a mad quest. Look, we can do this. And it's completely reasonable, and it will completely fail.
Completely reasonable, and then you see, what happens to him, and then...
Yes.
And it's immediately the outcome, but then his redemption immediately after.
Oh my god,
it's
so good.
And it's yes, he then sees himself what the ring does. In his last moments, he sees how he fell and how he sinned in the desperation for that power. Mm-hmm. That, yes, his heart was filled with good intention, but... That good intention corrupted him because the ring can do nothing but corrupt. The ring itself as a physical object is not an evil. The ring mm-hmm. itself does not do evil. It mm-hmm. enables you to be the worst version of yourself.
Yes.
And he immediately redeems himself in a completely badass scene. I think it was the Chivalric Guide is the Twitter account?
Yes, Chivalry Guide, I think.
Yeah, Chivalry Guide had such a good analysis of that scene in that this is how the orcs operate versus the honorable man. That even in his worst moment, he's won fighting against all those orcs, and they can only kill him after overwhelming him with the cheapest tactics possible.
And I haven't read that scene in a long time, but I watched the movie last week with a few friends. And like the moment where he's like, there's like two arrows in him, and like he's like, you could see it in Sean, what's his name?
Bean.
What's the name? Sean Bean's face. I was about to say Sean Connery, dude.
I like, oh, wish.
I can't. Yeah, that'd be amazing. Where you can see it in Sean Bean's
Give
face.
Give me the ring. Where he, I deserve the ring.
I deserve the ring.
Where I can shave Bondo.
He's like, dude, I took two arrows. I gave a good fight. It's like, I'm done. And then he looks behind him and he sees Merry and Pippin. And he's like, no, I got more in me. Like, I gotta keep going. I have to protect
yeah,
them.
Yeah, Tolkien so skips over good. That. Like,
yes,
Jackson
I know.
Has
I'm
to put that
about
into...
to say.
Yeah,
yeah,
Jackson
he's not
has
a big
put
fight
it in
scene
there.
He's not a big fight scene describer, our Tolkien.
No, because
but
it's
I
really...
actually really like the moments of fight because of, like, their how they're implied.
Yes.
If that makes any sense. They're
yeah, like, the only real
really
fight
well.
Scene you get is the Battle of Helm's Deep and the Siege of the Field of Pelennor. Those are the only real fight scenes you get.
And, oh, man, the Siege of... Like, I sent you that video of Tolkien.
Oh,
reading.
My God. I wish...
Holy
I wanted to have
shit.
My laptop ready as the soundboard, because I uh-huh. wanted to play that, but I didn't have the time, because I'm scrambling today, because Bird really fucked with my schedule, asked me to TLE with him.
Uh-huh.
But, my God. And such
Holy
a good...
Shit.
Such a good scene. And it's such a brief fight, too.
Yes.
Like, you're looking at, I don't know, 12 pages?
Uh-huh, something like that.
It's not a massive fight scene. You're not getting people beheaded left and right. Mm-hmm. You get the siege, you get the battle, and then you get the brief description of when Aragorn arrives with the ships.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And all that, three books are leading up. Like, this is almost the climax. Three
yeah.
books are leading up almost entirely to this point. And it's so short and it's so satisfying. But for a movie, of course, you have to put a little more fluff in there.
Yeah.
You have to tweak a few things. So it's a good adaptation, but it's not mm-hmm. true to the book itself.
Yeah, it should make you read the book.
Yeah.
But it's a good. It's as good an adaptation as I think they could probably
yeah.
do
no,
in
sure.
that time.
For sure. Especially because in the book, it's, yeah, Boromir scares off Frodo at the end of Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
You open up two towers,
yeah,
he's
two
dead
towers.
In 10 pages. You never even
yeah.
got to see the fight. It's
yeah,
entirely
and not only
implied.
That, two towers is split between the Aragorn and company and for half the book, and then the other
yeah.
half is like Frodo and Sam. And it's like it goes back in time to
yes.
when they were it's like, dude, that is an insane way of doing it.
No,
that
like we
a fucking psychopathic.
Like
way
we
of
like
doing
we keep
stories.
Saying, you could tell Tolkien was not a professional writer and did not have
yeah,
an editor.
No. Any editor would have fucking like fucking tore his hair out if he got that.
Yeah. No, like I'm going through Snow Crash right now, and you get maybe two or three chapters with one character,
uh-huh.
two chapters with another character. Two or three
yeah.
chapters with the main character, whose name is actually Hero Protagonist.
That's so good, dude. That's amazing. Okay, that actually convinced me to read Snow
it's,
Crash now.
When you open
amazing.
It up, when you open the first few pages are going to grab you because it's so insane. I was waiting for like the switch and reveal, like, oh, this is a guy fantasizing in his head. And it's like, no, this is just a description of how the world is now.
Yeah, that's so good, dude. Hero Protagonist.
And it's Hero, like a Japanese name. Hero.
That's amazing. I love that.
And you're like, there's no way he actually carries two katanas on his back. You know, he carries two katanas on
no,
his back
he
everywhere he goes.
Does carry. Yeah.
And the characters all have insane names. The characters all have insane names. There's one, Vitaly
awesome.
Chernobyl.
That's so awesome. Dude.
The other main character is YT.
Yeah, dude, I can absolutely see why this was a genre killer, because that is the naming convention for Cyberpunk.
Yeah, you don't
get
Uncle Enzo, the head of the mafia, but the mafia is a corporation now.
Uncle Enzo. Oh, that's so good, man. That's amazing.
It's so good. It's a really good book. I
yeah.
still don't know if I agree with Stephenson on personal level, but it's a good work. But,
mm-hmm.
yeah, where was I going with that? With the guy
you were talking about how, like, as compared to Lord of the Rings, Snow Crash is like two chapters of one.
Oh, yeah. So it's, you go like that. And it does help the flow of the book. And sure, you go
yeah.
back in time a little bit, but only by like a few days. And
uh-huh.
Yeah, The Lord of the Rings also, it's only a few days, but that's a massive few days.
That's
a massive
lot of things happen in those days, man.
It's when you get like the journey from the Shire to the Forest of...
Oh my God.
What's the name?
What's the name? Where Tom Bombadil is. That's
no, no, not even just that. The four is where the elves are.
Oh, yeah, but one before. Yeah, okay. Oh, I wonder is where that is it where, like, just beyond Farmer Maggot, basically?
No, no, I'm talking about where Galadriel lives.
Oh, okay, so way after that.
Map
I thought you were talking about in the beginning.
Middle Earth.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm not going to remember at the moment.
Let's see. Let's get that pulled up. Oh, of course, that's a horrible quality. Thank you, Wikipedia.
Hell yeah, dude.
Mirkwood.
Mirkwood, yeah.
Mirkwood is it Mirkwood,
Forest.
Or is it... Mirkwood is, like, surrounding it.
Oh, my God. You're getting into details. Like,
Lorien! Lorien! There we go.
It's in yeah, Lorien is the place, but the forest itself is Mirkwood, right?
No, no. Mirkwood is a separate forest. Lorien...
Oh, really? Okay.
...is over the Misty Mountains. So when they get to... From the Shire to Lorien...
Mm-hmm.
...is, like, 6 months.
Yep. Uh-huh.
And then the last occurrences of the book where everything happens... is like 2 weeks.
Yep. I mean, you can say a lot about Tolkien, but he knew how long it would take to fucking walk that distance.
He did. He didn't know.
Dude was a soldier in the First World War. And he was an avid, like, walker through the English countryside. He absolutely knew how fucking long it would take.
And so it's just these editor choices. And yeah, I think having an actual editor would have ruined the magic of Lord of the Rings.
Yes, it would.
But you can still tell, like... There's a lot of points where they're, like, characters will start speaking that weren't named before.
Yes.
When they're introduced. Like, when the Grey Riders come in.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien doesn't name the majority of the company until they speak.
that's true.
And you're like, who are you?
Who the fuck are you guys, dude?
And you go back and you're just like, well, they weren't introduced before this, so they're one of the Grey Riders. And it's like, yeah, if I were Tolkien's editor... I would have said, maybe name them more than two of the Grey Riders, because you're gonna name them?
Or maybe say, name the name, comma, a Grey Rider, comma, set.
Yeah. But then at the same time, it's like, well, who am I to argue with a cultural force like this? So it worked.
And it feels very Norse saga-y.
It does.
Like, where it's like, it's just like, oh, name things person said. It's not gonna have this novel-like structure necessarily.
Yeah, but works for a Norse saga because the audience will recognize different characters already.
Yeah, and yeah, or you can just like sort of work with it because it's like an oral tradition almost. It's like a thing that goes on.
Yeah,
with its
like
own
you know,
telling.
Like the Poetic Edda to us now would be confusing to someone then is going to know all those mythological figures.
Yeah.
Problem is, I don't know who Driel, whatever the Grey Riders is, because I've never heard of him before.
It's fucking news to me who this guy is. Like, but dude, I remember because someone posted this on Twitter like a while back, and I had like a flashback to myself reading it, where it was like a paragraph from Fellowship where they're setting out. I think they just left the Shire or whatever, and there's like three POVs in one paragraph.
Yes.
There's like Sam's perspective, maybe Frodo's, and then it switches to a fox who apparently has thoughts in words, and it's not like the fox thought something like this. It's like, no, it's like the fox thought words. And it's like, thought this was weird, and then it moved on, and it all happens in one paragraph, and it's three perspective shifts. It's insane. If any, like, writer with an editor did this, I would call it psychopathic. It's like, crazy.
Only Tolkien can get away with. Like, that is my advice for any writers listening to this. Do not do what Tolkien does, because you will not make it work.
Don't try.
There was only one who could make it work.
Yeah, maybe if you're a professor of linguistics at Oxford and you fought in a war and you've mastered, like, I don't know, fucking 10 languages or whatever and have created a few of your own. And
yeah,
been working on the mythology
baseline.
For like 30 years.
That's your baseline.
Then, okay,
if you can develop a functioning language,
mm-hmm.
then maybe I'll hear you out.
Yeah.
But none of us can fucking do that.
No.
He was on the spectrum, wasn't he?
Like, I don't know, dude. It's just, he seems so normal. He seems like just, like, a normal English curmudgeon who's, like, sort of has a wisdom to him when you see his interviews. But maybe he was, but, like, it feels very autistic.
He wrote an open letter to Hitler.
That's true, but that's what just you do as an English curmudgeon.
That's what you do. You're too old to fight in the war, so you're just like, well, Mr. Hitler, you are not a nice person.
Yeah.
I do not condone of this war.
I do not condone this one, Mr. Hitler. Would you please stop it? I invite you over for tea if you do.
I do not agree with the Jews, but I do not condone your treatment of the Jews.
Oh, man. I do wonder, like, his, like, test reader was basically his son. Like, for The Hobbit, it actually was, because it started out as bedtime stories for Christopher Tolkien. And then, like, when he started writing it, every chapter was sent to Christopher, and Christopher had to write a mini book report on it of, like, three lines. Like, some of them are available. They're, like, really short. But they're like, I liked it, but this part was a little bit boring, or the and then, like, signed Christopher. And it's, like, stuff like that was one editor for The Hobbit was his son, which is very adorable.
That is good lore. That is good lore.
Uh-huh.
No, it's just there's so much depth you can pick apart. Like, another one is going to back to Faramir and Boromir, where someone, I think it actually was, like, a Catholic writer drew the analysis of these are your two types of saints.
Ooh, that's a good point.
The one...
That's actually a good way to view it.
Yeah. You have one that gives in to the near occasion of sin and repents, and the one who avoids the near occasion of sin. Because Boromir gives in, and he dies because of it. Mm-hmm. And then you have Faramir, who assures Frodo and Sam that even if he found it laying on the road, he would not pick it up, because he's learned better.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest change that I remember from the book to the movie.
Yeah.
It's like Faramir is, like, tempted in the movie. In the book, Faramir is just, like, a Chad, and he's like, no, I would never do it. And he's, like, just... He's just being real.
Yeah, Faramir's he's like, really listen, we had to blindfold you to bring you into the secret tunnel, but I don't want the ring. We don't want to hurt you. We don't want to do anything to you. Don't worry about it. And technically, you're under my doom, and I have to bring you to my dad. But... we're going to stretch some rules and go finish your mission and I'll deal with the outcome. And then it almost kills him in the books.
Yes. Yes, indeed it does.
Denethor was just completely mad by that point.
Oh, yeah. Some great dialogue with him, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Denethor, man. Like, Gandalf and Denethor talking is so good. I just read a few of those pages, man. It's just amazing stuff.
And it's just amazing the staying power. Like, not even just in literature, but the pondering my orb meme is Sauron with his orb. What are the orbs called?
Palantir.
Palantir. Yeah. Yeah. He's just there with his and that became a meme 50 years yeah. after that animation. And nobody even knew where it came from. It's like from a Lord of the Rings tabletop game.
Oh, I didn't even know that. I thought it was like a tabletop game, which is like obviously aping Saruman.
No, it's actually Saruman.
It's actually just Saruman. That's awesome.
It is actually Saruman.
When did Saruman get the Cloak of Many Colors? Is that just in like the Scouring of a...
That's at the beginning of the...
Yeah, that's way before.
It's in the Scouring of the Shire, because then Gandalf, after meeting with Frodo, is late to meeting up with him and only catches him in Rivendell because he was imprisoned by Sauron in Isendur.
Okay. Yeah.
These are timelines that you have to actually think about it. Timelines is a horrific thought.
Yes. Despite the appendix, despite like his fucking autistic nature, I haven't read them, but I have checked out the appendices and it's like all like chronological. Like this.
I have it at the end. I have it at the end of my copy of Return of the King.
Return of the King, yeah, so do I. And which is hilarious because I originally thought it was going to be a much longer book, and then there's 100 pages after I read the final line, and I'm like, what the fuck is this?
You know how like some Bibles are going to have for the Old Testament, like, chronologies of the kings? And it'll have, like, the bloodlines of all the Abrahamic figures, and it's exactly like that. It is exactly like when you open up a Bible, yeah, and at the end it has the chronologies of the pre-Abrahamic figures, and their bloodlines, and the years they lived, and all that, like, wow! You actually, after finishing this story, sat down to write a chronology of Middle-earth. It's just insane.
One thing that we don't discuss, which is kind of hilarious, because it's influenced even Japan. Like, Japan's conception of elves. Like, how the conception of elves from Tolkien is, like... Like, I guess the Dresden Files is an exception because, you know, you sometimes have to escape from a trope. But, like, the elves from Tolkien are the de facto elves of fantasy. Like, that's it.
Yeah,
like,
you have...
it's over.
You have three elves. You have three elves. Christmas
mm-hmm.
elves,
mm-hmm.
which are nothing like the origin. They're just gnomes.
Yeah, they're gnomes. They're D&D gnomes, literally, because they're craftsmen.
Yeah.
They're tinkers in D&D.
Yeah, you have your Christmas elves, you have your Tolkien elves, and you have your fairy elves.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, elves
yeah,
are malevolent figures in actual mythology.
Yeah, they're not good news. Dude, all like the fae and the fairies, like, they can bring you good things or good things can happen, but like...
there's always a monkey paw
fucking
to it.
Be very careful when you meet them is like basically the tale, which is like, if you meet forces outside your comprehension, tread very lightly, act very respectfully, and whenever
yeah.
you can... back the fuck away and get out of there.
Yeah, be kind, leave them food, leave them drink,
yes.
but don't do anything else.
Don't, yeah.
And in Tolkien,
don't interact
like,
with them more than necessary.
No, these are actually noble beings. You know, like the pre-fall man.
Yeah, they kind of really are. They're kind of pre-fallen men. You know, yeah, because they live kind of forever like Adam would have, like Adam would have died if he hadn't sinned. So they kind of do have that sort of pre-fall men thing about him. I always interpreted Tom Bombadil as closer to, I guess, Adam. As to closer to Adam and Eve.
I don't know where Tom Bombadil really falls into it, because he's
yeah,
not...
no one knows. That's the big miss. That's always the big mystery of Lord of the Rings. I remember someone on Twitter arguing, like, I've seen several, like, good friends on Twitter arguing for different takes on Tom Bombadil, and the fact that they're all good, and they all have, like, pretty good evidence to support their claims, like, you can't really categorize Tom. I really think it might have been, like, a peak of inspiration for Tolkien to include him. Because he does add something to the story, but I don't know if there's a certain je ne sais quoi about him.
Yeah, it's something that if he was left out of the story like they do in the movies, it wouldn't harm the plot.
But
it
harms the
him,
feel of a story.
Yeah, adding
the
him,
world, there's something
it's just
to
this...
it.
Like, it helps to have him there. There's no complaints
yeah.
of having the whole Tom Bombadil section.
I mean, the most memorable Tom Bombadil moment isn't even when he's on screen for me. It's like when Frodo mentions them at the Accounts of Elrond. We met this crazy dude in this forest. And Elrond is like, oh, yes, he is older than old. He is older than me. He was here before the first rains fell or whatever he said. Like, oh, holy shit. And, like, versus, he might be nature. He might be, like, an incarnation of nature. He might be something else. I don't know. But it's such a great mystery to have, and the fact that, like, Tolkien, even in the Silmarillion, doesn't really talk about the creation of Tom Bombadil or how he came to be, like, never. It's such a great mystery where you can sort of just ponder on it. And he talks about this in one of his letters, that he says he thinks one of the reasons Lord of the Rings did well is that it didn't solve all the mysteries. It solved enough things and let you know enough things that the world is coherent and it makes sense.
Yeah.
But what really captivates you is the glimpses into these far sights that you can never reach. Like, I think he wrote something almost exactly like that in one of his letters. And he's so right, and so many fantasy writers... who like to hard magic systems to systematize everything, to categorize everything in their stories, miss that point. Hard.
Yeah, because that's like Arthur Clarke says, like, any technology that is beyond comprehension is akin to magic. Like, you need a level of mystery to it, because then you're just creating technology.
Yes, that's true. That's
like,
a good point.
You need that this is just, there's some rules to it. Gandalf can't start a fire with nothing. There has to be something there that he can burn. He's not God.
Uh-huh.
But beyond that, you're not getting, like, oh, this is the complete explanation.
I cast fireball! You're not gonna get... He doesn't take a ball of back guano and throw it at Saruman at some point in the story.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, again, going back to Butcher and Dresden Files, I think he does that well, and there's enough of a... metaphysical aspect to the magic that's not explained
yes.
how this, like, works, in that, yeah, there's no scientific explanation of, oh, well, the atoms actually arranged in a certain way. It's like,
yes.
human will sort of coalesces into this
uh-huh.
thing that alters reality around you. So, yeah, you can cause a fireball to happen because you're coalescing, like, the atoms around you are being forced, but you're still starting with something, and something is being given up, but there's enough of a mystical element to it we're not like, oh, well, this is actually just physics in a different universe.
Yeah, like you get an, like the angels are all in Dresden Files are a good example of this, where you get enough of a sense of how they might or might not work, so when they do or don't do something, you can understand why they're limited or able to do such a thing. But also, you can't, there isn't like, I completely understand how the angels operate in every single instance case. There's no, like the angel of death is actually a good example, like, doesn't it? Because we're seeing it from his perspective. He has no fucking idea how the angel of death in ghost stories work. Like, he fucking shits his pants, actually.
Yeah, especially since the angels aren't supposed to be able to affect the human world. So all of a sudden, you get one that does, and it's like...
Yeah, you get one that does, and he dressed up shits his fucking pants, because the angel knows his name perfectly.
Yeah, it's, and you need this level of mystery, because when you try to solve everything, you're never going to finish what you're writing. You actually try to solve everything, because you're going to make threads that go nowhere, and that's interesting, because that's a living world, because it has to reflect the living world. When you write something, when you live, do you solve every mystery before you die?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it really, yeah, I've read a lot of Rand Sanderson when I was a teenager. I enjoy him. But man, he does fall into that.
And these are the things. Like, this is the blight of the fantasy world. That they want to do Tolkien, but they don't understand. Like, and you don't have to take a college level course. You don't need to get a master's in understanding Tolkien. But you need to understand the basic framework of how this man operated. Mm-hmm. And the first one is the Catholic framework, that there's no good or evil in his world because everything is a degree of fallen. Mm-hmm. From the source of there is good, there's the source of good. And everything is the degrees from it.
There is good and there is the corruption of good.
And that's all there is. That's all there is. There's no pure evil. So that's the first thing. There's no good or evil in these worlds. And that's why morally gray stories are interesting. But then you fall into something like a Martin writing Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. Where actually edgy characters do bad things. They're actually good characters. It's like, you're halfway there.
Yeah, you're almost close. You gotta tweak it a little bit.
Tweak it a little bit. Like, they have to have some intention of good here. There's nothing wrong with a self-serving character because self-serving people exist in real life.
Yes.
Not every person thinks that they're doing a good thing. Some people enjoy doing bad things. That's not every single person on Earth.
Yeah, Wormtongue is actually a good example of that. Even Saruman, who's like, if I don't ally with Sauron, I won't survive.
Yeah.
Or Wormtongue, who kind of is just a dickhead. I forget his
motivation
in the books.
Sort of and he dies because of it.
Yeah, he's just a dickhead.
He dies because he kills Saruman, and then he immediately dies after, and it's like...
Immediately.
And yeah, it's like, you can have your self-serving character, and there's no issue whatsoever there. But you need variation. There needs to be people that have bad intentions and do good things, good intentions and do bad things, because that's life. Mm-hmm. That's just life. You're writing because you're writing a living world. So your morality can't just be black and white, and it can't be amorphously gray, because neither of those things are interesting, and neither of those things are captivating stories.
There needs to be a... If you really want to write a story with gray characters, there needs to be a good... a pure white, a transcendent thing to contrast that.
Yes.
Because then we can sort of see the gray. There needs to be a light... It's a light source that we can see the gray from, or else it's just like nothing. It's just like blackness.
Even The Witcher does that better. And that's from
Warkowski,
who
Sapovsky. Yeah, it's something like that.
Sapovsky, who is a vehement atheist.
Oh, yes.
Unrepentantly atheist.
Unrepentantly.
But,
which is weird for a Polish man,
exactly.
But whatever.
But what culture does he come from?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So you're going to.
I didn't know that! That's interesting. I discovered Sapkowski is a non Gentile name, let's say.
Yeah, he is. He does come from a Catholic background, but.
Oh, okay.
He comes from Poland. So this overarching sort of Catholic theme is going to be there. He tries to make the church and the Church of the Sacred Flame, or whatever the fuck it's called, be unrepentantly evil.
Uh huh, yes.
But at the same time, well, so are your sorcerers and. Witches, so...
Yeah, so it balances
out. So actually, they're not doing that much evil, because, yeah, they're killing some of the wrong people, but they're also killing some of the right people.
Yeah.
And then your main character is the perfect example of there's a what's allegedly a morally gray character, but he actually has an objective moral code.
Yeah.
Geralt has an objective moral code that even stands out amongst witchers.
Mm-hmm.
So, here you go. You don't actually have morally gray characters, because they're all... driven by something that can either be greater than themselves or might not be. Some of them are politically driven in that they want to have all the power, they want to advance their station in life. And some of them are driven into the bad things they do because they want to achieve something else. Yennefer loses herself because, well, all witches have some defect. So mm-hmm. she makes herself beautiful because she's ugly. She wants to strive to something greater than her.
Mm-hmm.
Geralt is corrupted by love because with the djinn, he sort of makes Yennefer fall in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Triss does the same thing. She takes advantage of amnesia. These are all driven by something that's not just, I want
these
power.
These are very understandable characters.
Yeah,
yes.
Some people are driven by power, and some people are driven by a moral, and maybe the moral code is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the moral code is half right, half wrong. There's differences. So even Sapkowski does better than Martin, who's just like, okay, here's an edgy character, and here's 20 pages of a feast.
Let's just describe food for the next book and a half.
Gee, I wonder what you were thinking of, badass.
Yeah, he's busy writing 20 more dinner scenes in Winds of Winter. That's why it hasn't been released
yet.
Yeah,
it's part of the reason I can never finish Song of Ice and Fire. But then the other thing is, don't tie up everything, because we like chaos. Why was the blue so popular? Because it's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Why is, like, organically produced music better than digitally produced music? Because it's not perfect. Because even when you have an orchestra, there's a whole symphony playing, and you perceive it as perfect. If you actually listen closely, there's imperfections.
Yes.
One of the common things that musicians disagree about is where the A note actually is. Because there's two different frequencies that can produce an A note.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, there's two different hertz for an A note. And that's part of the beauty of it, that the A note is not actually an A note, because there's two different notes you can play that sound similar enough. So there's a dissonance to it. Nothing's ever perfectly in tune. It sounds right that way. We like a little bit of chaos.
Yeah, we do.
We like things when you're able to finish the story, and not every thread was tied up, so you're sitting there, you're thinking, like, actually, what happened here? What could happen?
Exactly.
You're like, you want that chaos to sink into it, because you're thinking of real life in that sense.
Yeah, there's a, like, even in Lord of the Rings, like, Sauron is defeated. Okay, congratulations, you defeated a lieutenant of Satan. He's still there. Like, this isn't the final battle, guys. This is, like, a in the grand scale of things, a notable but small victory.
Yeah.
For the race of men. It's like, that's, like, good, you did that, but this is not the final battle upon which all evil will be defeated.
Because it's a history. There's always going to be that. You destroyed a massive source of corruptive power. But it's a history, so we know that, okay, eventually those continents are going to shift and it's going to turn into the world that we have, and men are going to do all the evil things that they've done over that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. That's good.
Yeah. There's a reason why it's not, like, the revelations of, like, Middle-earth. This is that it's the apocalypse. It's where, like, okay, we're done here, boys. Eru Ilúvatar comes down and, you know, fucking smacks down Morgoth and fucking... You know, there's a reason why Tolkien didn't write that one. Because, one, he'd just be writing Revelations, and as he told C.S. Lewis, if you just wanted to tell people to read the New Testament when talking about Narnia, you could just tell them to read the New Testament. Instead of writing a book.
Chad Catholic versus the Virgin Anglican.
And he's such a curmudgeon. Like, almost every single book, even the ones he liked from Lewis and from other writers, he almost always speaks badly of them. And it's like, so, like, every book he likes, he never comments on.
But
all
then
the
his most scathing criticism was, I rather dislike this book. About Doom.
Dude, it's like, what was it? He had another criticism of, like, another criticism of Narnia was, like, you know, if a real satyr met a young girl in the forest, there wouldn't be tea and cake. There'd be a rape. <You're> like,
Professor, he says that. He says that. But then what does he do with elves?
He's like, only I can do that. You see, Lewis.
Yeah,
I write mythology. You write little novels for children. Yeah. I write mythology.
A real satyr would have raped that little girl. Now, anyway, these elves do not deal with you. They just hide in the forest, and they're pure beings.
That's
like, no, the elves would also, maybe they wouldn't rape you first, But they steal your soul.
Yeah, steal your soul too.
They carry you away to fairy.
Yeah, they steal your children and replace it with like a copycat.
Yeah,
we do something crazy like that.
Again, we can't fault this man because he's done something that none of us will ever fucking do. Uh-huh. And that's influence. Make Western canon in a fiction story, in a fantasy story, in the 1940s. Because, yeah, what's his face? The one that blew his brains out, wrote Farewell to Arms. Why is his name? Hemingway.
Ernest Hemingway?
Hemingway. Yeah. Hemingway entered the Western canon, technically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did.
But he did it writing normal fiction stories.
Yeah.
Tolkien comes in with a alternate history of the Earth. Written like a Norse saga. No editor. And enters the Western canon.
I think it was the best-selling book. Like, if you exclude the Bible, it's the best-selling book of, like, the second half of the 20th century.
Probably.
Maybe of all the 20th century. I think it was, like, excluding the Bible again. The best-selling novel, I should say.
The man
the
wrote
century.
His own Beowulf, his own Song of Roland, his own poetic.
Yeah, he translated the Beowulf. He translated Beowulf, by the way. He's one of the main one of the popular editions of Beowulf is translated by Tolkien.
There you go. So this man is just, we'll do something that none of us will ever do. So you actually are not above criticism to Tolkien if you are a person like that guy on Twitter that said it's over. You are not worthy of criticizing Tolkien on the simple merit that you have done nothing that even mimics what he does.
And he's actually very careful about his theology. Like, if you actually read, a lot of those criticisms of Lewis are not this is badly written. It's like Screwtape Letters or the last book of That Hideous Friend, the last book of the space religion, that usually, like, Orrin McIntyre really likes and people talk about on Twitter. And it's like, I haven't finished the space trilogy. I'm halfway through the second one. And it's pretty good. And Tolkien really liked the first two, and he helped get it published. Like, C.S. Lewis helped Tolkien. He actually really encouraged him to write Lord of the Rings. It probably wouldn't have happened without Lewis, like, really encouraging him. But he really didn't like the last one, because he basically says Lewis didn't have his theology right, and that really bothered him enough that he didn't enjoy the book, and he thought it was bad. Like, Screwtape Letters, also, he was like, I wish Lewis would have matured more spiritually and theologically before he wrote this book.
So basically, Lewis, I wish you would have become a Catholic.
Yeah, it really is, like, almost every interaction they have that I know about them, there is this undercurrent of, like, I fucking converted you. Why the fuck are you not a Catholic? What is going on here?
That is just amazing. it is that is a very funny detail. Tolkien was just a character matter. There will never be another, and nobody's gonna replicate. Every fantasy book is now a derivative of Tolkien, because even when it's like trying to break a trope, now it is derivative of trying to break a trope of Tolkien. So you are just.
He's the standard that you kind of have to set yourself against in many ways. It's from characterization in fantasy to world building to the metaphysics of the story to the meta-narrative of a story about what it is to be a hero and so on. And how do you make the small seem great? I love Aragorn. I loved Aragorn as a kid. Since I first watched the movies, he was always the coolest character to me. Like, I know, and the favorite character of everyone is Sam. It's like, he becomes your favorite character as you grow older, and you understand the story. It's like, and you get, and like, Tolkien has said this in a letter. But Sam, like, the real hero of Lord of the Rings is Samwise Gamgee.
Yeah, he did say
Gamgee.
That.
Like, yeah, obviously. And everyone who's read it, like, gets it. And they understand, like, this is the bravest man, courageous man in the story.
The thing I'd like to end on is, actually, I did have a conversation with Noam a few weeks ago where he was texting me. He was really frustrated that people put Sam and Frodo's journey above Gimli and Legolas, like, amending the division between dwarves and elves. And he was like, no, that is a greater achievement. I was like, Sam and Frodo's the Jesus part of the story.
What the fuck are you talking about? That's, like, the crux of the theological metaphysics of the story. It's like, who cares about this fucking fantasy racism? I wish they would hate each other. I don't care.
I mean, we're talking about
they're probably still racist. Legolas probably is still racist to dwarves, and Gimli's probably still racist to elves.
Yeah,
opened one exception.
Yeah, they found one of
the
good ones.
But this guy's they found one of the good ones. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, I can't be racist. I have an elf friend.
Gimli started simping for elf pussy, found one elf friend, and was like, yep, yep, that's good, that's good.
He wouldn't like elf pussy. It's too non-hairy.
It, yeah, yeah.
They don't have the beards. Yeah,
just like, just, that's the best detail I ever put in my D&D world, that the female dwarf hookers all have beards. Because that, directly inspired by Tolkien.
Yeah, inspired by the greats.
He said, I think that's also one of his letters, that yes, the female dwarves also have beards.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember if it's in the books, but they put that in the movie, and I'm pretty sure he has established that somewhere in the lore.
He did establish that. It's in one of his letters, I'm pretty sure.
Oh yeah, by the way, if you want more Tolkien in short dose, please read Children of Húrin, which is like pretty short. It's not like, it's basically novella length. It's the, I think it's the most recent thing of Tolkien I've read in the last year. It's really good.
It I will is, be, yeah. I will
it
be
is far
more
pessimistic, though, in a sense. Like, that had the good ending. Children of Húrin has a noble ending, but it is a tragic ending, like a Greek tragedy, where there is a nobility to it, but it's like, it's bad. Okay. Things get bad.
That's life. That's what makes these things interesting.
Yeah, and that's why, like, that's the easy counter to it. It's good versus evil and good trans. Like, actually, no. Sometimes evil just wins.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you can't
not
do
at,
much.
Not at the end of the day. Not at the end of time, but for
yeah,
now.
Not at the end of the time, but sometimes, yeah. Like, Elrond talks about it. I have been witness to fruitless victories and crushing defeats. It's like, yeah, all his battles, all the victories have been fruitless, and all the defeats, we get smaller and smaller and push more and more back until the end of time where we will triumph. But until then...
Yeah.
That's the way it is.
Yeah. And that is an excellent place to wrap it up. Luis, thank you so much for coming on, man. This was an absolute
blast. It really was.
All right. And then, fellas, next week I believe it is going to be Caleb on. So prep yourselves
Hell
for
yeah.
that.
Everyone, get your Caleb decipherers out.
It comes in your cereal boxes.
It comes in your cereal boxes. Your cognitive dissonance cereal boxes.
That's my next script. That's where we ended off on. Soul Bra is now making socks. I'm making cereal.
Hell yeah.
No dude. Seed oils. Just come.
No seed oils. You should mark, was it Kellogg's, which originally advertised itself as capable of stopping masturbation?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, you should market it like that. It will be popular among the rad trad community.
Yeah. Mine has my cum in it, so you don't have to.
So you...
The
dude, every time I hear "so you don't have to," I just think of a nostalgia critic. And that's what I imagined. It's like, man, has my coming it, so you don't have to.
And with that, that's where we wrap.